boys and girls, moms and dads. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Yogeshwara Das. I think my daughter-in-law has me on, you know, Twitter handle Yogi Dad or something like that. I hail from New York, and every once in a while I get the great pleasure of coming down to spend time with my son and his family and to see the beautiful deities and to appreciate all the amazing progress that's happening here in Alachua. It's really quite something to see. Then people are kind enough to ask me to try to say something. So here we are in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, about which I will admit to you up front, I know nothing. You know, 10th canto, even though we make children's books out of these stories, you know, and in India, children grow up, you know, hearing these stories the way children in the West hear Grimm's fairy tales or Andersen's or something. And yet Bhagavatam is not for children. It's for the Paramahamsas. It's meant for very, very profound devotees, people who have reached a very deep level of understanding. But we will do our best, because it's Srila Prabhupada's instruction that we attempt to understand these deep teachings. So, text 11, you recite the Sanskrit of these verses? Yep. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Canto 10, Chapter 40, Text 11. Sattvam Rajastama Iti.
Sattvam Rajastama Iti.
Bhavatak Prakritir Guna.
Bhavatak Prakritir Guna.
Teshuhi Prakritak Pruta.
Teshuhi Prakritak Pruta.
Abrahma Svara Svastavaradaya. Sattvam Rajastama Iti.
Sattvam Rajastama Iti.
Bhavatak Prakritir Guna.
Bhavatak Prakritir Guna.
Teshuhi Prakritak Pruta.
Teshuhi Prakritak Pruta.
Abrahmastavaradhaya. Spirit souls on the left side of the temple room, like this. Abrahmastavaradaya. Satvam, goodness.
Raja,
passion.
Tama,
ignorance.
Iti,
thus known.
Bhavata,
your.
Prakriti,
of the material nature.
Guna,
the qualities.
Teshu,
to them.
He,
certainly.
Prakrita,
the conditioned living entity.
Pruta,
woven.
Abrahma,
up to Lord Brahma.
Stavara Adaya,
starting with the non-moving creatures. Translation of text 11, and then we'll go right into reading the translation of 12, 13, and 14. Through the end of 14 or through the end of 15? End of 15. Okay. Goodness, passion, and ignorance. Now this is Akrura speaking to Krishna and Balaram, saying, goodness, passion, and ignorance, the qualities of your material nature, entangle all conditioned living entities, from Brahma down to the non-moving creatures. I offer my obeisances unto you, who, as the supreme soul of all beings, witness everyone's consciousness with unbiased vision. The current of your material modes, produced by the force of ignorance, flows strongly among the living entities, who assume identities as demigods, humans, animals. Fire is said to be your face. The earth, your feet, the sun, your eyes, and the sky, your navel. The directions are your sense of hearing, the chief demigods, your arms, and the oceans, your abdomen. Heaven is thought to be your head, and the wind, your vital air and physical strength. The trees and plants are the hairs on your body, the clouds, the hair on your head, and the mountains, the bones and nails of you, the supreme. The passage of day and night is the blinking of your eyes, the progenitor of mankind, your genitals, and the rain, your semen. All the worlds with their presiding demigods and teeming populations originate in you, the inexhaustible supreme personality of Godhead. These worlds travel within you, the basis of the mind and senses, just as aquatics swim in the sea or tiny insects burrow within an udumbara fruit. Now, mind you, all this is from a chauffeur. I'm sure you're all now familiar with the backstory here that Akrura, who is working in Kamsa's kingdom, was deputed by Kamsa to go and bring Krishna and Balaram to Mathura. And Akrura, who's heartfelt devotee of Lord Krishna, takes this as such a great benediction. What a great opportunity to actually go and see Krishna. Very excited about this. And the whole way there, he's just meditating. He's in this state of, you know, lolium, this intense yearning, and utsaha, his enthusiasm is high, you know, and he's single-minded, vyavasyatmaka buddhi. He's just completely focused on where he's going, what's going to happen when he gets there. And he's imagining what's going on in Vrindavan. And all of these things, he hasn't been there before. It's his first time to Vrindavan. How many of you have been to Vrindavan? Okay, that's our show. Bye. You already know this stuff. But for Akrura, the anticipation, the imagining of that, you know, kind of edge of your seat anticipation of seeing Krishna was just overwhelming. When he finally gets to Vrindavan, the first thing that happens is he sees the footprints of Krishna and Balaram and the calves, and he gets down off the chariot, rolls in the dust, just in ecstasy. And Prabhupada, in his purport in the Krishna book, says this is the right way to enter Vrindavan. He says you don't get to Vrindavan with an airplane ticket. You get there by your enthusiasm. When you get there, you roll. And then when he finally finds Krishna and Balaram, they're tending the cows, and it's just like he'd always imagined. And now he's offering these incredible prayers, these amazing, wonderful prayers. And Krishna and Balaram receive him with so much love. You know, they've been waiting. They say, "Oh, we've been waiting to see you." And they sit him down, and they wash his feet, and they bring him prasadam. You know, this is an amazing reciprocation. And finally, the time comes when he has to take Krishna and Balaram from Vrindavan, and the gopis go crazy. They just can't bear it. And as Akura is taking them off, you can see it, you know, on a big screen. You know, the gopis there as the chariot recedes farther and farther into the distance. You know, and the gopis watching the final dust raised by the wheels of the chariot as it settles in the distance. They go back brokenhearted to their homes. Meanwhile, Akura has his heart's dream fulfilled, and he has Krishna and Balaram with him there. So he, along the way, they stop to take bath. You know all this already. You've heard this, no doubt, from speakers this past week. And so Krishna and Balaram sit under a tree while Akura takes his bath, and they play this trick on him. And they show up in the river, and he's, wait a minute, left him under a tree, and he goes back to the tree. And he goes back, and they're there on the ocean. All of a sudden, they're surrounded by demigods. These are the amazing scenes. Goes back, and Krishna and Balaram, they say, "Well, did you see something wonderful?" She looks so surprised. "Did you see something?" And of course, while they're still there in Vrindavan, Akura gets to sit in on the conversation, because Nanda and the cowherd men are sitting there, and they're talking about this, and they say, "You know, so what is up with Kamsa? You know, what's the news? Tell us about what's going on." And Akura, you know, there's a bit of a shift in mood. Right? You know, that heart's dream has been fulfilled, but now it's time to get down to business. So they're talking. And he's saying, "Well, Akura is a bit of an anachronism in our community." And that's the word, that's the translation of the word that Prabhupada gives in the Krishna book. He's an anachronism. Anachronism means his time has come and gone. He doesn't belong here anymore. He needs to be brought down. He's causing so much trouble. So Krishna and Balaram know that the time has come for them to show what they can do. So they follow him, they get on the chariot and go to Mathura. And then when they get down in Mathura and it's time for them to go their separate ways, Akura says, "Look, there's one more thing that I'd like to ask of you. Would you, you know, come over to my house later? I want to show you my altar." And Krishna and Balaram say, "Sure. Oh yeah. Well, we gotta kill some demons first. But as soon as we're done with that, we'll come to your place." So, you know, I'm thinking about these incredible pastimes and saying, "What could I possibly say about all this?" Well, I guess the first thing is, don't think small. I mean, Akura had this wish to see Krishna. Right? Not only did he get to see Krishna, but he got to have Krishna and Balaram over for lunch at his house. And all of that's possible. You know, it can be done. You know, if you're sincere, if your heart is surrendered to devotional service, Krishna is so appreciative. He's so appreciative. And yet here he is espousing this extraordinary philosophy and very profound ideas. Very profound ideas. So what I was thinking, what does that mean? Well, that means that scholarship and devotion are not antithetical. We should always be studying. Prabhupada always appreciated, right? I mean, Pushkar, you remember this. Prabhupada always appreciated when his students were reading his books. It was a little embarrassing, but in Geneva one time, you know, Prabhupada's room was right next to the room that I was staying in, and he was walking by, and he always see me reading a book. So right in the middle of a morning Bhagavatam class, he said, "Just like our Yogeshwar, he is always reading our books." And but he appreciated. He liked people to know the philosophy. He didn't want us just selling books. He wanted us to know the books. And he held two fingers up one time. His intelligence is that close to the soul. Your Krishna consciousness has to be grounded in knowledge. Otherwise, what happens? I'm not rhetorical. I'm asking you. If your devotional service is sentimental, if it's not grounded in knowledge, what happens?
Temporary.
Huh?
It's temporary.
Temporary, and because it's temporary, then what happens? Then you'll go away. You'll fall down. How many thousands of people did Srila Prabhupada initiate? Where are they now? You know, we don't know. Somebody, and why was this? Because it was their understanding was not grounded in knowledge. So study of these books is not, you know. Here's another thing. I learned this trying to explain Bhagavad Gita in yoga studios, which is what I do a lot of the time in New York. I teach in yoga studios. People have no idea what they're hearing. This takes discussion. You can't just read it on your own in a vacuum. Reading means discussing. Right? Reading means discussing. This has to be discussed together. You know, in yoga studios, they bandy about these terms. It's like, drives me crazy. You know, working out your karmas and your, you know, fulfilling your dharmas and, you know, wearing your charmas. I don't know what they have no idea what they're talking about. You know, they're terms. They're just words to these people. You know, these are complex ideas. And bliss. If I hear that word one more time, I'm going to throw a whoopee cushion at somebody. You know, he's in bliss. Bliss is this very, very profound emotion. When we talk about Akrua being in bliss, you know, that doesn't mean he's at some, you know, bhakti rave, you know, jumping into a kirtan mosh pit or something. It's a very, very deep spiritual experience that's only achieved by people who have really come quite far in their spiritual life. And so these are very profound ideas here. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes. Hey, how you doing? Us old timers, we get to do that, you know. Hey.
Is this working? Okay. So, you were just mentioning how many thousands of devotees Prabhupada initiated, and where are they all now? And I keep on hearing people saying that, you know, most everybody has left the movement. So statistics say over half of Prabhupada's disciples, initiated disciples, are still connected to ISKCON. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure the percentage, but it's over 50%. Right? Well, there's about 4,700, something over 4,700 disciples, and over half.
Well, that's encouraging news.
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
A better statistic, but I for sure know it's more than
the question half. Still stands, where are they? I mean, I see three. There are three in New York.
Okay, just clarify that.
They're somewhere out there. That's great. That's good to hear. Any other questions? Yes. Pushkar.
As you mentioned, grounding in knowledge. Okay, grounding in knowledge. Hare Krishna. I've had some pretty brilliant people that had a lot of knowledge, but we don't see them either around, but they may be doing other things.
I'm sorry, a little louder?
There's some pretty people who were grounded in knowledge that aren't around either.
Yes. Okay, good point.
So we may not be able to hold that up as a criterion either, because...
Well, we know that there are two tracks that we follow. Right? There's the knowledge track, and then there's the practice track. You know? Pancharatrikabhiti and Bhagavata. We have to have both things there. Right? So if you just study, it becomes dry. And if all that you do is kirtan, then that gets sentimental. So both things need to be there. But I think you're absolutely right. My experience has been that there are some people who take shelter in academia because it's just easier. You know, it's easier to go scholarly than to actually dig into the hard work of purifying your heart of all the stuff that's in there. So you can kind of posture yourself on this illusory, you know, edge between the two if you get degrees and become an academic, because then you're espousing knowledge, and arguably you can say, well, I'm teaching Bhagavad Gita. But there's this aesthetic distance between the knowledge and the actual heartfelt practice. And I'm not judging anybody. I'm just saying that sometimes I think, and then you have to ask yourself, why is that? Why would people take refuge in knowledge? Well, look, it's a hard thing sometimes to identify with the Krishna culture. You know, there are some, the other, you know, 50% who aren't attached to ISKCON, a number of them aren't because they just have a hard time identifying with the culture. They're intellectually oriented and maybe they have a hard time saying, I can't bring my friends here. I mean, you know, think about it, people, really. You know, what's our value proposition out there in the world? You know, excuse me, sir, do you have a moment? Yes. Okay, you're not your body. Excuse me? No, you're not a man, you're not a woman, you're not American. Okay, what am I? Well, you're an eternal spark of God, and when you learn to give up all of the habits and all of the things that you've acquired knowing about yourself during your entire life by chanting these names, this mantra, over and over and over and over, then you go back to the spiritual world. Really, what's that like? Well, the cows are conscious and the clouds are conscious and it rains only at night and the snow is warm. And God is this blue-skinned boy who plays a flute and wears a peacock feather and flower garlands. And you kind of chant a dance all day long. But if you can't make it, don't worry about it. Because if you chant, then you'll take your next life in another human body and eventually maybe you'll get elevated to a higher planet where there's oceans of mango juice. What's your name, son? Sriman Sankirtan Das Brahmachari. Sri, can I call you Sri? Yeah, well, Sri, that's an amazing story you've just told. I have just one thing I need to say to you after all that. Yes, sir, what is that? I got to go. I mean, good luck to you, really. I mean, I wish you success with whatever it is you're doing. It's a beautiful mythology that you're living with. You know, lots of luck to you. Bye-bye. You know, I mean, it's difficult. And then, all right, well, let's say I accept all this. Now what do I do? Well, change your wardrobe. Yeah, I mean, and on and on and on and on. I mean, I think you get the point, is that it's difficult sometimes for people to just envision themselves living the life that we live. It's not really necessary to take to this lifestyle. But if people sometimes have a hard time identifying with Krishna consciousness, it's not because the philosophy doesn't hold up. It's very often because the people they meet aren't able to reassure them that this is something natural. That you're not being asked to radically become somebody you're not. We have a real responsibility out there. I guess that's the most important thing that I can convey to you. Don't judge anybody. There are people out there, they may not take to a devotional lifestyle. They may not move into a temple. Man, they've got a lot of important devotional service they're doing out there. I have people coming to Jiva Mukti Yoga School who are working in Syria and in the Ukraine with women and children who have been devastated by war. You know, rape, child victims of all kinds of atrocities. There's one woman who comes who is a special needs child development expert. She uses yoga with children who have autism or cerebral palsy or whatever it may be. You know, and these are, you know, full-fledged chanting. They're devotees. They don't live in temples. They don't wear the cloth, but their life is Krishna conscious. And I think that's probably the job that Prabhupada entrusted to us, is understand that the world is in constant evolution. It is always evolving. And your job is to keep up with that. Your job is to understand how to present things according to the time and place and circumstances so that people can appreciate it. If we just wait for people to get where we're coming from, we're going to be kind of lonely. We have to go to them and understand where they are and be compassionate to them as they are now, not as they might be someday when they see the light and live the way we do. Yeah.
This might be a long, complex question and answer, but I'll try to not make. I guess what interests a lot of us, or a lot of us are concerned about and discuss and think about, is, you know, how we present Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. And there's a wide variety of ways Krishna consciousness is now being presented. And I can see that things like that you're doing have a absolutely incredibly wonderful value, and that you're reaching people that we might not otherwise reach, and you're actually bringing them to Krishna consciousness to the point where they're chanting, etc. And then sometimes we see other endeavors are maybe a little farther, you know, in other words, it's, you know, a little more remote. And sometimes my concern is that in our attempt to reach all sorts of people and be very, you know, very liberal and very accommodating, that we don't lose the essence of our Vaishnav culture and our Vaishnav traditions. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've thought about this a lot. How do you see that we balance this?
Obviously, you've been reading the GBC minutes. Yeah, that's kind of all comes down to that. That you've just put your finger on one of the most significant questions of our time. That's not a small or insignificant question. On the one hand, we have a responsibility to protect the tradition. Yada yadahi dhanvastivlana. Krishna comes to this world because people stretch the envelope too far and the whole thing gets spoiled and lost. So that's a real risk. We have to protect the tradition. At the same time, if all that we are is librarians, then we're irrelevant. If all that we're doing is passing the same books along, then what value do we have? We have a responsibility, along with respecting the tradition, to also make the accommodation to the application of those teachings in an ever-evolving world. What do we have to say about fracking? What do we have to say about climate change? What do we have to say about armed conflict? What do we have to say about poverty, HIV/AIDS? What do we have to say about women sold into sex slave? What do we have to say about children who are registered in armies? What do we have to say about genetic engineering, you know, GMOs? What do we have to say about anything? What is our relevance in the world? What difference does Krishna consciousness make in people's lives? It's all very theoretical and abstract most of the time. You know, well, you're an eternal soul. There's a supreme being. You know, there's mantras. There's this way of being that we call bhakti. And who knows what that is? You know, but my grandmother had this wonderful word, taklas. This word means, like, what's, give me the real goods. Give me this, the meaning of it. Give me the bottom line. What do I do with it? So it's a really important question. Now, in my, you know, doddering old age, I've come to respect the conservatives. You know, the Vajranarayans and the Rabindra Swaroops of the world. Very important role they play. They keep liberals like us from going too far overboard. Yeah. They're the ones who make sure that the tradition is kept intact, that the essence is not compromised. They're the ones who make sure that the sampradaya remains strong. Without that, we're finished. We're sunk. And yet, if you look historically at the evolution of faith cultures, you do not look to the clerics for change. By virtue of having to play that role of guardians of the tradition, the innovations have to come from the laity. The changes and innovations come from the congregants, not from the religious leaders. So it's usually the Rihastas and you know, the people living out in the world who have the prerogative of experimenting with those applications, and how do they work and how do they not work. So those two things need to work symbiotically, and then you got something. Now you're cooking with gas. When you've got that strong, scripturally grounded, institutionally healthy foundation, and the energy and the people out there in the world to figure out how it applies, all right, now we can go do something. And I would venture to say, just as a follow-up there, that every one of us in this room right now and everybody out there in, you know, la-la land has one obligation, and that is to figure out what is your unique contribution to Prabhupada's mission. Don't become complacent. Don't think that you've reached your plateau. I want to see 1 ounce of evidence, 1 shred of evidence, that anyone here has reached the limit of their contribution to Prabhupada's mission. Show me 1 shred of evidence that you don't have some extraordinary, magnificent, magisterial contribution to make yet ahead in your life to Prabhupada's mission. Just look for it. Be on the alert for an opportunity to serve Prabhupada's mission.
It seems like you're talking about 2 different things. In our own conviction, we are going through an evolution, you know, obviously in our Krishna consciousness. But I find when I go out and I preach, people are not on that level. You know, like you said, there are many terminologies out there, you know, vegan or vegan, karma, yoga, whatever. But when you talk to them, I find that, you know, they're not so evolved in their consciousness. So like I was giving this one person a book, and he said, he said no to everything I said. You know, I was saying to improve your life, to become God conscious. So finally I said, why don't you get some good karma? You know, take the book, you know, read it. And he said, oh, I'm having good karma. So I said, okay, how about not having any karma? Now, good karma or bad karma, transcendence. He said, oh, that's a new terminology. So sometimes they're not so knowledgeable about Krishna consciousness. So something very simple, and we can't forget, like, Lord Chaitanya intervenes, you know, when you don't know what to say, and he helps the spirit soul. So there's so many, it's such an individual thing, and it doesn't depend upon our own self, you know. Lord Krishna is there, or Lord Chaitanya is always there. So sometimes, that's why preaching is so, it brings you and the other person to a whole different kind of consciousness.
Mm.
Because Lord Chaitanya is there. It's not just what I know and what the person knows. Because Lord Chaitanya is from the spiritual world, I mean, he's God. So when you preach, many times after a transaction, or I find that, wow, what just happened? You know, and then many times, because I'm always out there, many times I meet the same person. Recently I met this one girl, and she said, I tried to give her another book, and she said, don't you remember me? And I said, yeah, and I don't really remember her. She said, I was having trouble with my boyfriend, and you were telling me to treat him the way I wanted to be treated, and not use him as sense gratification. And I said, I said that? And she said yes. And she said, no, I want to hear some more. You have something else to tell me? And so I gave her a book. So sometimes it's just very simple, you know, just some common sense. But in my own spiritual consciousness, I go through what you're saying. You know, I hear these things, and
mm-hmm.
you hear, you get involved. But when I go out there and preach, I feel all these have disappeared, and I'm here, you know, for a whole different reason. But at the same time, I'm making some spiritual advancement.
Yeah, now you're talking about something very, very important. Our interactions with people are not mechanical. When you meet somebody, I mean, look, this isn't just on Sankirtan. How about your own family? How about listening to your own family for a change? You know, I mean, it took me, I've been married, I don't know, forever. How long have I been married? However, like 30-something years. It took me 15, 20 years to realize, wait, I should be listening. Compassion, the way Prabhupada demonstrated it, means you actually love somebody. You actually love them. And if you love them, then they're not the object of your book distribution. You know, they're the subject of your attention. You know. So that's a beautiful thing that you're talking about. You know, that's elevating Sankirtan to a whole other level. You know, where, look, it's a cold, cruel world out there. I mean, what do people want? They want somebody to acknowledge them. Sometimes that's all it takes. You know, it's like, wow, you're talking to me? You know, you're acknowledging me? Thank you. Because most people are very lonely. They're out there, no one's listening to them. You know, nobody cares about them very much, you know. So to actually be cared for, you know, that somebody is interested in your well-being, wow, what a gift that is. Yeah, beautiful story. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd like to know a little bit more, if you can share with us, how you do help move the yoga community closer to Krishna, closer to a philosophical understanding of the bliss and the mantra chanting, because I'm in that arena too.
How do you move the yoga community forward?
Well, individuals, but I'm just saying, from your own teaching experience, you could share more.
Well, you know, most people, when they come to a yoga class, you know, their conscious mind is telling them, you know, we're going for a good stretch. Their subconscious mind is saying, well, I want quality of life. I want maybe here I can find some answers to questions. Maybe here I can find some better understanding of myself. Because yoga studios, my impression is that they're very much today what churches and temples used to be. People used to go to church for good company, for some inspiration, for, you know, being in a place of goodness, for hearing wisdom, and so on. Well, that's not happening very much in the traditional places of worship. But when you go to a yoga studio, there's at least the veneer of that, you know. And on top of it, it's got this physical dimension, so you feel good. You know, you do yoga and it releases all these endorphins and you're feeling good. So what's happened, of course, is that over time, the more thoughtful people have come up and they said, what's that thing that we chant before yoga? What's that Om thing? Yeah. So it's gone a little deeper now. And there's a place in yoga studios for bhakti and for philosophy and for Bhagavad Gita. And I think it takes some knowledge of yoga to talk in a yoga studio. You have to have some, you know, you have to know who Patanjali was. You know, you should know something about, you know, what is Ashtanga. You know, and how do you connect asana practice with devotion? There are connections. There are links between the different postures and, you know, an opening of the heart. Why is it that when people practice yoga and they go into heart chakra poses, they often start crying and they don't know why? Something about the heart, you know, they're literally stretching out of old modes of how they think of themselves and opening themselves up to possible other dimensions of what they might be. Now we come in with Krishna consciousness, bang, you got a sandwich. So it's often, but it's the same thing, it's listening, it's mostly listening. I've learned the hard way to not talk too much. Don't do that. Those of you who give class, just shut up. You know, it's like 15 minutes, okay, 20 minutes, boss, you know, and then just like let people say what's on their mind. Should be a dialogue going on. It takes about 3 minutes. Boom, the whole thing comes down to relationships. That's what they want to know. Can't give a class in the yoga studio. How do I deal with my boyfriend? Question number one. You know. Then you get to other things. You know, but what do I do with, you know, so relationships are a real problem for people. That and career. Yeah. Let's give someone else just.
Karibal.
Your name is?
I listen to my family. Going back to what Tomohiro Prabhu said, you were saying that there were conservatives and liberals. It just seems like a very carefree way to look at it, because you're saying, okay, I'm considering myself a liberal, and I'm just going to go out there, and it's their job to reel me in. And on a more individual level, how do you keep that balance? How do you know what to hold on to and really see what the value of what you're trying to do is, instead of assuming somebody else is going to do that for you?
Good point. Very good point. I know for myself, I have a real problem when it comes to the kirtan movement, you know, the kirtan culture that's growing out there, because I look at it and I go, this is like entertainment. You know, where's the devotion in it? You know, where's the heartfelt offering of a prayer to Krishna? You know, where did that go? You know, have you ever been to any of these, you know, things? You might as well just buy a ticket to, you know, Roosevelt Field. You know, I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, what Gauravani's doing is awesome. You know, I love Jayutal, very sincere, heartfelt devotee. You know. But so then I go back and forth, like, you know, do I not like it? Do I like it? Is it conservative? Is it liberal? What is it? You know, they're chanting, you know, after all. You know, but then I think, yeah, but they're chanting, and down front, you know, everyone's waving their arms, you know, and then, you know, then, hey, you know, you want to go catch some dinner? Oh, have you seen the new, you know, Russell Crowe movie? You want to go? So, you know, what is that? I don't know. I'm having a hard time understanding this assimilation of Krishna consciousness into a much larger cultural context where there's a new definition of what a devotee is, almost, you know. They don't really know the philosophy. They don't live in temples, but they love chanting. They love prasadam. You know, their friends are devotees. I don't know. It's a very hard thing sometimes. So I guess for me, the position I've taken is I won't judge them. I will draw the line and try to figure out for myself what is too much and what's too little. I want to make progress in my own life, and if I can set an example, then it almost doesn't matter. People are doing what they do. I mean, look at us old fogies. You know what, we didn't have a kirtan yoga culture around us when we joined Krishna consciousness. What got us started, you don't even want to know. You know, we don't talk about it anymore. A little embarrassing where we came from, you know, to become devotees. At least these people, they're starting with kirtan. How can you say no to that? You know. So if they're not up to the standard yet, you know, if they're kind of loosey-goosey with the rules and regulations or whatever, well, okay, give them a chance. You know, things take time. People come around. But don't you compromise. Then nothing works. I think that's the point. You know, the reason why the conservatives are important. Look, it was just this year. What is it? GBC was founded in 72 or something? So that's 30, 40, whatever years it's taken to come up with a course of study that you got to pass before you can get initiated. Hello. When we were initiated, Prabhupada would say, who is Krishna? He's God. All right, here are your beads. And that was it. You know, now you've got to register. You have to have a mentor who supervises you. You've got to know the philosophy of certain books you have to read, certain essays and questions you have to answer. And then you have to have a recommendation. You know, it's about time. You know, they put some, you know, some guidelines in place there. So all of that's really good. That's very important. Not everyone's going to jump to that level right away. So I think overall it's really healthy. It's really good what's going on. I'm seeing amazing things. And I think we're going to see more amazing things in our lifetime. Really, really wonderful stuff. People in positions of, like people who are like heads of departments of psychology. I've got one guy from Rhode Island who comes to Jiva Mukti on Tuesdays. He's head of the psychology department at Rhode Island University. Right? He's teaching. There's a woman who works in The Hague, you know, with the International Criminal Court. Where do these people come from? You know, it's like amazing. It's wonderful.
Question. Do you think we need like more effective or stronger leadership? I mean, if Prabhupada came back tomorrow, I mean, what do you think he would do? I mean, do we need people to rally the troops? And all those comments you made about relevance, like where does the movement, you know, where does it stand on these world issues, etc. So perhaps you could say something on that.
If Prabhupada came back tomorrow, what would he say, looking at the movement in its current state of affairs? The first thing he would say is, thank you very much. He's always appreciative of any effort. Then the second thing he would say is, why haven't you taken over the world yet? I gave you everything. What are you waiting for? And then getting practical, I think the first thing he'd say is, why don't you have a stronger presence on the internet? He's saying, I did not give you just books. I gave you knowledge. And if the world has evolved since my day, when books were the source of knowledge for people, and now the source of knowledge is digital technology, why aren't you masters of digital technology yet? Go to where the people are. Go to where they get their information. He'd say, you're behind on your internet presence. You're behind on your media. You know, you're behind on, you know, getting courses of study out there. So just get back to work. You know, and he would say, don't get complacent. You know, don't think that now I've reached, this is it, you know, Prabhu. This is, I don't want any more drama in my life. This is all I can do. I've been through that, all that, you know. I'm okay now. I've got my thing. No, you don't. Your thing, if you're a devotee, is what more can I do? So I think he would just be encouraging us to do more. You know, and to take stock of the world. He'd want us to know what the world is, what's going on in the world today. Very important to understand. The world we live in.
I got the class. I have my iPhone and it has 3G, so I heard the whole thing. But this is a little closer. This is a smaller point that I do think touches upon some of your larger themes. I heard the internet, how you were talking about what does Christian conscience have to say about fracking, or what does Christian conscience have to say about this social issue or that social issue. And I think it is very important that we're seen as being able to engage in the world and give people practical courses of action to come to the real essential points, which is the bhakti. Because there's a lot of people talking about fracking from a million different points of view. And what do we really have to say about it that's essential to the process of bhakti yoga? I'm just using that as an example. And is there just one thing that we should be saying about it?
Look, let's... All right, good. It's a good model. It's a good pilot. Here's the deal. You go back to the roots of economic theory. You know, go back to Adam Smith, go back to the early economists, and the thinking was that we need a structure in place now that we're in a free market capitalist culture that will assure that people have the right to pursue their dreams without harming other people. So the capitalist system, the economic system, the theory was, let's establish guidelines which will allow people to basically fulfill their dreams. You know, go out and build your kingdom, right? There was no understanding in these early stages of economic theory there that the assumption of nature as this unlimited source of resources was fallacious. That notion, that vision of going out and conquering the world, basically subduing nature, harnessing nature, building the culture around us, unlimited supply, unlimited goods, free trade, etc., was predicated on a lie, namely that nature will continue to provide us the raw materials as long and as quantitatively as we want. And now we've been suffering the consequences ever since, because we've been raping the earth, we've been exploiting nature, and now we're dealing with the after effects. And it's utterly tragic, and we're bordering on substantial risk to the health of the future of the planet, and therefore our children and grandchildren and their children, etc., where there will be food shortages. There's already a water shortage, where the sea levels rise as a result of the emission of gases released by the tundra at the poles. And the idea of fracking as somehow a less detrimental way of releasing gas and getting more fossil fuel out of the ground is a fool's logic, because it's still predicated on this old antiquated idea that progress means getting more. Progress does not mean getting more. Progress means learning how to be happy with less. It's understanding that we don't need to exploit the earth. Read third chapter Bhagavad Gita. At the beginning of time, the Lord of all beings sent forth generations of men and demigods, as well as sacrifices to be performed, saying, be happy by the performance of these sacrifices. Doing so will bestow upon you all desirable things. If you know that there is a divine relationship with the earth, and you respect that relationship, you will never lack for anything. Put a bag of seed on the ground, a bird will come and take a few grains and go away. A human being will come along and take the whole bag. We have not learned to control our own greed and passions. Therefore, why is fracking objectionable? Not because it is less destructive than oil, petroleum-based energy. Not because it is more economical than other forms of technology that have not yet been adequately developed. But because it's predicated on a lie, and is predicated on a lie that perpetuates a deadly system of social organization. Right? The time came somewhere along the way in the development of this economic capitalist system when the definition of what it meant to be human changed. Prior to capitalism, where things were workshops and you know, guild-based, artisan-based, people had time to meditate and to pray and to read scripture. And their spiritual life was rich and full. They weren't working 12, 15-hour days. Forget about it. You work 3-4 hours, and then you'd go home, and you have time for friends, for family, for cooking a meal. Life was closer to nature. Everyone knew that there's God. It wasn't a big surprise. Then along the way, when the culture around us became based on taking your profit and reinvesting it in the means of production, the Industrial Revolution, building your workshops, and all of a sudden, instead of handicraft, we've got mass production. You can make more, sell more, get more money. The definition of a human being changed. Now you are no longer a divine spark of God. You are the sum total of all your desires, wants, needs, dreams, and hopes. And the success of your life is the fulfillment of all those needs, hopes, and urges. At that point, the system became master, and the people and citizens became the reason to keep that system alive. Instead of economic theory now providing a way for people to be fulfilled, people now existed in order to fulfill the system. So people are out there being sold this lie that happiness means buying more nonsense. You know, as long as it, why is Krishna consciousness so radical? It's because it's so un-American, it's so un-capitalist, it's so un-free market economics. We say buy less.
This sounds like a very good analysis for a certain class of people. What I'm driving at is, what's the essential aspect of our core program that is relevant here?
The bottom line
is, this the only way?
No, the bottom line is
that can be engaged.
Take your system and compare with our system. Ours is more profitable. People listen to money, follow the money. You want to know how to convince somebody? You tell them our system is more profitable. It's that simple. You know, look at your, here, I'll give you an example. Dean Ornish, who when Clinton was president, he was his cardiologist. Dean Ornish, who was a disciple of Swami Satchidananda, practices yoga, meditation. He was the guy who got apples and salad into the Wendy's, you know. he has a program that includes yoga, vegan diet, not vegetarian, vegan diet, and other support systems, which he has now gotten into insurance policies nationwide. There are insurance companies that pay for his program, that pay for people to practice yoga. He's the only one who has been able to do that so far. How has he been able to do it? Well, I interviewed him. And he said, well, you know, if I had gone in to the regulators and said, you know, we want to help people get back in touch with their inner self, we want to bring them peace of mind, we want them to have a happier, less stressful lifestyle, they'd thank you very much, there's the door. Instead, I go in with the MRIs. I go in with the stats. I say, look, here's the data. These pharmacological-based programs for helping people reduce stress cost about $15,000 a year per person. They have an 86% recidivism rate. Here's my program with yoga and vegan food. It costs $1.50, and it has a 6% recidivism rate. Any questions? This is why we have to learn how to take our philosophy and put it into a contemporary vernacular. The same thing, but talk about it in a way that people can understand. This life is simply more economical. It's more productive. It's more environmentally friendly. And for heaven's sakes, people are happy. And they're healthy. Any questions?
Yeah, so basically you're saying that a lifestyle in the mode of goodness is more productive than a lifestyle in the mode of...
Well, it goes back to what Mataji was saying. You have to go to people where they are.
Yeah.
You know, if you would try to convince them that Saguna Brahman is superior to Nirguna Brahman, they're going
to
just, you know, walk away.
People,
that's right. Understand. Listen. Open these two little holes in the head and figure out where people are at and talk to them on that level. Understand what their concerns are, what their needs are. And they're legitimate. Don't put them down. Karmis. What a word. Word. Karmi. I don't get that. Anyway, any other questions? Are we done here? It's 9:09. We have another minute or two?
Yeah.
All right. Anybody got a simpler question then? I'm sorry?
Have you written any books? I mean, if you haven't, you should. So.
Moi? We need lots of books. We need a whole new generation of literature. We need lots of books.
I was thinking about, you were saying we all have a unique contribution. And I always feel that mine is, because I have this opportunity with my job to just sit in an airplane with, you know, one person for 3 days straight. I really have the opportunity. But so many times, and I beat myself down because of it, I'm not able to break through that wall. You know, that, you know, all the only appropriate thing, you know, it's the unsaid rule, is we can talk about union stuff, we can talk about making money, or, you know, talk a little bit about our families, but it's so hard to, you know, develop the courage to really, or find the way to get through to someone, because I can feel, you know, just sitting next to the person, I can feel, you know, they have a heart, and their spirit, soul, and, you know, if only I can find a way in to open up that conversation and contribute in some way. But, you know, pretty much the way I operate at this point is I just wait for Krishna to open the door, you know, and I'm too shy to really, because I don't want to, you know, rock the boat or rock the airplane. So I don't know if you have any recommendations.
I mean, you know, your instincts are obviously good about that. You know, if you turn to your co-pilot and say, you know, have you accepted Krishna in your heart, he's likely to ask for a transfer. You know, you got to break the ice. You know, you only have a few minutes really to establish a relationship with somebody, and you can't go wrong asking them about themselves. You're probably doing the right thing. Never mind you. Ask somebody about them, and they'll love you. I don't know how many times I've been at dinner parties or, you know, whatever. You know, just tell me about yourself, you know. And they'll be, yep, 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 all about them the whole night. At the end of the evening, I've heard them talking to somebody else, saying, oh, he was such an interesting guy. And then, you know, you find a point of entry at some point. And the next thing is just be honest. You know, don't posture, don't unburden yourself of that sense of obligation that I must now carry forth the word of Chaitanya. You know, I mean, if you keep that kind of, you know, ego, it's hard to really be a warm human being whom other people are going to want to ask about. You know, if they like you, then they're going to naturally say, well, how'd you get into that? You know, what's that all about? You know, I've seen, you know, people on the streets, but what is it, you know? So if you can get them to that point of just feeling comfortable enough to ask you honestly a question, then you're home free. You don't have to, don't force it. You can't force anybody. It's like, you know. Yes, someone who has not had the microphone before now.
Hare Krishna. First, I wanted to thank you so much for the wonderful class and very heartfelt. You made a lot of different points that I can see that in my own life, it really did make a big difference in my preaching. Like the point you made about getting into their world. Because for me, I see it that it's not that you're changing the philosophy, it's just different levels of it, and they're just at different levels. And so, like, for me, I worked with children with severe autism, and I had to go to their level, even though it was not my level and it was not the level where they should be. But unless I went to the next step and then the next step, they weren't actually progressing. If I expected them to be where typical people would be, they would never make any advancement. So I feel like just keep the goal in mind, whatever it takes, you know, if it means I'm going to be on the floor and just getting at their level, and then finally you get that connection. If I didn't go to their level, they would never connect with me. If I asked them to come to my level, it's impossible. So I feel like, I didn't feel like I was, you know, kind of watering down the philosophy. I just felt that they're just, I mean, it seems like in Krishna consciousness, you read Bhagavatam, and even you see in Prabhupada's life, I mean, when he first came to America, he didn't ask everybody to just be pure devotees. He went to their level and brought them up. If they were smoking, then he said, then smoke less. And, you know, like, whatever they can take, it seems like. Because I remember I was preaching in Ireland, and there was two girls there, and I remember, you know, they were asking me questions, and I could see it was way above their head. They were asking about deity worship, and I thought, how can they understand? I tried to explain, but they couldn't. So I just gave them friendship, lots of prasadam, and then, you know, within weeks, they wanted to chant, and then after that, after a few months, they wanted deities. And it just kind of, I realized the Krishna factor. It's not really me doing it. It's like once their consciousness is purified enough, Krishna reveals it to them. Like they weren't ready at that moment, but we just have to be patient. That they will eventually get there if they're sincere. And if they're not, then it's not up to us. We just have to give our friendship and...
I'll confess something to you. It's a little awkward to say it, but even at, you know, this stage in my devotional career, if you want to call it that, you know, when I first moved into a temple, it was 1969, so you do the math. I have no idea. I still judge people. You know, I still find myself meeting someone and going, oh... you know, and then afterwards, like, whoa, boy, did I misjudge that person, you know. And in a sense, it's understandable, because what is that tendency to judge? It's actually a survival instinct. It's a self-protective instinct of the mind. The mind's job is to protect you from danger. So the mind's business is accepting and rejecting. Well, what is that based on? It's based on past experience. So if your experience has been that somebody with a knife is dangerous, you're not going to necessarily be thinking, well, I wonder why they're carrying, you know, what was their childhood like, you know. You know, your mind's going to say, get the heck out of there. So that tendency to judge is a healthy self-preservation instinct. Now here's the downside. In order for the mind to have that function working freely, about 500 other things have to shut down. Reflection, deeper thought, contemplation, analysis, compassion, all of those other qualities that take time to transpire. So, you know, don't reject the process, because that's a healthy thing. You know, if you're seeing something that could be dangerous, move away from it. But we do have to be cautious of allowing that preservational instinct to color or to obscure our knowledge that this person is also a spirit soul, and being respectful to them.
Along the same lines of what Vaishnavi was saying, we judge people because we think we have greater knowledge of them, of life or Krishna consciousness or whatever. And it's also important to remember that they've been conditioned. So you can't judge somebody by what you think your knowledge is or what you claim knowledge to be. Like with Radhika, who has cerebral palsy, there's something going on with her body that's limiting her. So similarly, other people have things that have happened in their life that has made their brains grow in a different way than yours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just very important to remember that. And like she was saying, go to their level and not judge them for what you might not think is, you know, intelligence. Because everyone does have intelligence in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to say that.
Yeah. That's very, very hard to do. Very hard to do, to be in that place where you are so sure, so self-assured in your own Krishna consciousness that you can step outside of that certainty of yourself in order to listen to people with ears wide open and not judge them. That takes a lot of courage, because it means allowing yourself to enter into their space where you may be vulnerable to whatever they're going through. And to not be touched by that. To be there for them in that place. Because someone's got to make the gesture. Someone's got to step forward. Why do things not get resolved in the Middle East? Why do things happen like in the Ukraine? It's not because you got, you know, rootin' tootin', rough shootin' Putin running around on a hobby horse waving his wooden sword in the air. Yahoo, we're going to take over the, you know, we're going to get our old countries back. It's because people refuse to take the first step of saying, we will put ourselves in your space and listen to what you have to say. You know, there's such suspicion now. It's so deep-seated. You know. So ultimately, I think that's what Prabhupada wanted us to do. That's where I think he wants us to be. In that place where we can step outside the parameters of what is comfortable for us as devotees, in order to be in a place where we can actually start affecting change in the world. Ultimately, I think that's where we're going. So, all right, thank you very much for your wonderful questions.